Hey guys, it's Lauren jumping in before the episode starts to let you know about our West Coast tour that is coming up in June. Did you see the photos from our East Coast leg and have a serious bout of FOMO? Have you been thinking of a California sojourn, perhaps? Why not join us at our San Francisco date on June 16th? The next day we'll be in Portland on June 17th, and Seattle, we will be bringing our demented PowerPoint to you on June 18th. And for those who live in Los Angeles, your time has finally come. We will be playing the Bourbon Room in Hollywood. That's right, we are not making you drive downtown. On June 28th and June 29th. And yes, Southern California fuckettes, this is our only SoCal date. Sorry, San Diego. Tickets will be linked in the episode description. We hope to see you there. And now on to today's episode.
I spent $40,000 on shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the
thing. Can't you buy our old dress?
Moral, the thing.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. Chelsea, how the hell are you?
I'm good, although we both just realized that we've done something horrible, which is that we forgot to rabbit.
Look, we had a lot going on.
There's nothing worse than when you wake up to one of Sarah Jessica Parker's rabbit videos and you're like, fuck, I forgot.
Since coming back from tour, there's always that great thing when you go to the East Coast or Europe or something and you come back to the West Coast and you go to bed very early and you're like, you know what? I'm always going to do this. I'm going to start being an early to bed person. So I went to sleep very early, but where I messed up was I stupidly started talking to Paul when I woke up instead of rabbiting the first second I woke up, although it's rabbit.
I know. I talked to my dog, unfortunately, instead of rabbiting.
What'd you say to Mr. Biggs?
I don't know. Like, let me take you outside so you could go to the bathroom. I don't know. What do you say to a dog in the morning?
I say, hello, Frosty. You're so cute.
Yeah, it was probably some shit like that. Anyway, so something horrible is going to happen to us. See, that's the bad thing about rabbit is it really is superstitions. It is obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, and now I have this thing where I'm like genuinely scared of not rabbiting.
I mean, this is how my brain works, but I'm like, is there a Blumhouse film we should be pitching here? Like, if Ouija's a movie and It Follows with Smiling, like, is this our version of that?
Oh, God.
Loosely inspired by the Instagram reels of one Sarah Jessica Parker.
The experimental films of Miss Sarah Jessica Parker.
I feel like we could safely say that that at one point was going to be part of our live show, and then we sort of, in the editing process, were like, I don't know if this carries over.
Yeah, it was a little too niche, perhaps. Not that there weren't many niche aspects of that show. Anyway, thank you to all of the fuckettes that came out to our shows on the East Coast.
And the plus ones, whether you were boyfriends, moms, gay boyfriends who valiantly listen to our podcast, despite the fact that you do not care about the things we talk about. We appreciated seeing you there.
Yeah, we really do appreciate you. We did record a little VIP episode before our Chicago show, if you want to check that out. But we mostly just talk about the hotels that we stayed in. So maybe not that interesting. I don't know.
I was surprised at how well received it was, because sometimes when we record, it's all a blur. But I was acutely aware of how much we talked about each hotel in each city. And I was like, is this going to be interesting to anyone? Friend of the show, Evan Roskatz, did let us know that we should not have stayed at the Kimpton in Pittsburgh. We should have stayed at what he calls the iconic Renaissance Hotel.
Okay, well, we know for next time. But honestly, I'm so sad that we're not still at the Nobu Hotel in Chicago. Like, having to go back to my normal life, having to clean my fucking house, not having turn down service. Like, what fresh hell is this?
It's interesting because the lead up to the tour, there's a lot of stress. We were figuring out a lot of stuff. And while on tour, I was referring to the tour as a working vacation. And in the moment, as we were doing a show, leaving City Winery at 10, trying to find a bar we can have a drink at that wasn't closed.
As if we ever left a City Winery before 11. You're crazy for that.
You're only proving my point. So then we would try to find a drink. Then we would fall asleep, wake up, drive to the next city, in the moment last week, I was like, wow, this was not the vacation I thought. And then I got back to my life here. And the place that we're staying at right now, I completely forgot we left a total mess in the run-up to the tour. So yes, I agree with you. I came home and had to clean the entire house, go grocery shopping, all of that. And this week has been catching up on basically putting one's life on pause for 10 days. And I turned to Paul and I was like, wow, tour really was a vacation.
No, absolutely. It was so fun. And it was so fun seeing people. I got so many great Taylor Swift friendship bracelets.
Yes, for people who are coming to the West Coast leg of the tour, just know, if you, like Chelsea and Tat, went to the Eras tour and have all of these beads left, making every outfit related friendship bracelets and handing them out, great use of these extra beads.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very touched by that. Also, if anyone's wondering what our thoughts on the tortured poets department are, we also talked about that in that VIP episode. A lot of fuckettes were surprised that I did not stan that album. And I have to say, I've now listened to it all the way through several times and I stand by my initial read. So there you have it. I like the handful of songs that I like.
Ooh, I like this. You're really teasing the VIP episode. It's like, want to know what my favorite tracks on Taylor's most mid-album is?
Yeah, well, I feel like they're kind of everyone's favorite track, so it's probably not that exciting.
Much to my surprise, although it makes sense, And Just Like That is going back into filming. Why I'm surprised is it feels like the show just ended in my mind, but it does make sense because Sex and the City, when it was shooting, notoriously always shot.
it always was shot in the summer. Aside from like that last season where we got that wintry, you know, those wintry episodes.
All right. Episode one, they're back. And guess who's joining them, Chelsea? None other than Rosie O'Donnell, cast as Mary?
Okay, I'm so hyped on this. All we know is that she was at the table read for the first episode. There's been no announcement about her joining the cast, which leads me to believe that she's a guest star and not a series regular. Although, who knows? We don't really know.
Yes, I love how our caption on Instagram was like, our Miranda love interest of our dreams. And like the first comment was like, wow, way to spoil it. It's like, guys, we don't know anything.
I know, like Carrie could have another queer podcast boss played by Rosie O'Donnell for all we know. But I just imagine that she will be a love interest for Cynthia Nixon just because that's incredibly legit casting. Like that is very like Brooklyn lesbian couple.
Absolutely.
Also, like Rosie O'Donnell and Cynthia Nixon, like literally in the same dating pool, running in the same circles, certainly in life and on And Just Like That.
In retrospect, it is odd that Rosie O'Donnell was never a guest star in the original run of Sex and the City. I suppose she was a little busy and perhaps too toxic post The View.
She would have still been doing the Rosie O'Donnell show when Sex and the City was on.
The Rosie O'Donnell show ended in 2002.
Okay, so there you go. She was fully a popular daytime talk show host. It would have made more sense in the sort of Sleepless in Seattle, League of Their Own character actor period of Rosie O'Donnell's career.
Don't forget about Stakeout 2. There's a whole host of sequels of movies that I've seen way more than the originals.
Also, shout out to Exit to Eden. And the fuckettes that brought us a DVD of Exit to Eden at the Chicago show.
Oh my God. Also, shout out to the lovely fuckettes who, during the DC show, sang me happy birthday, brought me gifts.
I know, you got all sorts of B-Day gifts.
Although Chelsea got me the greatest gift of all, a cameo from George Santos. Unfortunately, you got me a cameo from George Santos the week before he started to do cameos as his drag persona.
Oh, really?
Have you not seen this?
No, that's amazing. I'm really sad about that. But still money well spent, I think.
All right, and Just Like That's coming back.
Oh, also, did you notice that, like, everyone else that posted from the table read, like, posted photos of the scripts, covered the title of the episode? Not Rosie O'Donnell. So,
what's the episode called?
Outlook Good.
All right.
So, they said that And Just Like That isn't coming back until 2025. So, now I'm thinking that means, like, January.
So, this will be the rest of our year, is just covering the comings and goings of shooting on And Just Like That.
Yeah, while I would love Rosie to be a long-term girlfriend, it would be delightful if she was just a girlfriend of the week and we just got a bunch of random fabulous actresses coming in throughout the season to go on horrifying dates with Miranda. Old school stuff.
Can't wait. Of course, I'll be writing some season 3 fanfic in my head because I can't help it.
Well, actually, since we're on Rosie O'Donnell now, kind of perfect transition into Barbara Streisand, Rosie O'Donnell's hero.
That's true. Yesterday, we were watching clips of the old Rosie O'Donnell show, which bless all the demented millennials like us who have just uploaded their VHS copies of the Rosie O'Donnell show onto YouTube.
I remember I used to tape like iconic, like when Madonna was on the Rosie O'Donnell show, I fired up my VHS tape. I taped that shit. But bless the people who actually then transferred this footage to YouTube.
Again, we always say it, the amount of money I would pay who? Peacock?
I would pay like $20 a month just to access like a 24-hour Rosie O'Donnell show channel.
And if she did commentary tracks on different episodes.
Oh, priceless.
Just a channel that's literally just the years 1998 to 2002, like old E! News, old Live from the Red Carpet, old E! True Hollywood Stories. Our entire Gen Z audience is like, let me just skip ahead 30 seconds.
Yeah, let's actually talk about Barbara Streisand.
Streisand.
So she left a very funny comment on Melissa McCarthy's Instagram.
Melissa McCarthy was with the choreographer Adam Shankman. They were there for the Center Theater Group Gala. She's posting about that. She and Adam Shankman are both in pastels. And Barbara Streisand just zooms in and writes, give him my regards. Did you take Ozempic? No punctuation between those two thoughts.
I love it.
It's also comforting to know that a celebrity of this caliber actually is handling their own social media.
Look, of course you shouldn't talk publicly about someone's weight or like ask them if they're using Ozempic, like in an Instagram comment, but like Barbara Streisand is in her 80s and we can't expect people of that generation to like change their fucked up attitudes towards weight, you know? Like, I think that Barbara is part of the silent generation, but even like baby boomers will say the craziest shit to your face. Like, you could literally be like dying of anorexia and they'll be like, you look amazing. Like, I wish I had your discipline. Or you could gain like 10 pounds and they'll be like, oh, my neighbor's daughter lost 50 pounds on Weight Watchers. You should check it out, you know? And that's just not gonna change.
No, and what makes this even better is her apology post, which she says, oh my God, I went on Instagram to see the photos we'd posted of the beautiful flowers I'd received for my birthday. Who's the we? But okay. Below them was a photo of my friend Melissa McCarthy, who I sang with on my Encore album. She looked fantastic. I just wanted to pay her a compliment. I forgot the world is reading. So she's not like, I'm sorry I accused her of being on Ozempic.
But also I think that just because people aren't talking about Ozempic, like celebrities aren't really talking about it publicly, aside from Oprah, it doesn't mean that there aren't sort of free and open conversations behind the scenes among celebrities. So I think maybe Barbara Streisand just did forget about the public nature of it.
Yeah, like I remember Steve Martin talked about how he, Tom Hanks, Martin Short would all do their colonoscopy prep together. And I have to imagine that there are Hollywood circles that are like coordinating their semi-glutide use together.
Well, I think it's more just like, so many people are on it that it like there's a degree of openness about it now
within the world of celebrity.
Yeah, but like obviously they're not going on TV and talking about that shit because people would be judged for it. So,
well, also given the reaction to Oprah admitting it, I don't think any celebrity is like, ooh, this seems fun.
Yeah, I would love a whole news cycle about my Mounjaro use.
I love when old people publicly comment and think it's a private DM.
I wish Melissa McCarthy could have responded. She couldn't because Barbara Streisand deleted the comment.
I went to Melissa McCarthy's Instagram to try to find the post. It seems like that's deleted too. There's now a video of her reading, I believe it's Barbara Streisand's biography, and that's sort of her comment to it. She says, at Barbara Streisand fan club members only, ! Heart emoji, heart emoji, heart
Wait,
emoji.
Was this after the Ozempic comment?
Yes.
Okay, amazing. Iconic. Yeah. See, she doesn't give a shit, no. So why should anybody?
curious about how you can achieve smooth, natural-looking, long-lasting filler results? The Juvederm collection of fillers has 6 unique gel fillers that add subtle volume and are designed for different needs in specific areas of the face, like lips, cheeks, chin, smile lines, under eyes, and jawline. Ask your licensed specialist for a full face assessment today and download the Ally app. That's Alle, the official loyalty program of Juvederm, to save on treatments and get a look that is true to you. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Build healthy habits the easy way with nutritious recipes from the number one meal kit for clean eating. You know I'm talking about Green Chef. Yes, Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating and ranked the number one meal kit overall by US News and World Report. While I was away on tour, I had my Green Chef delivered to my parents' house thinking they'd store it in their fridge for when I got back. But wouldn't you know it, my mother cooked one of my meals and has fallen in love with Green Chef. Hint for fellow fuckettes who never know what to get their parents, I have the answer for you. It's Green Chef. My mom was amazed by how fast the meal came together. Most meals are 30 minutes or less. She loved the pre-measured ingredients, with even some of the produce being pre-chopped and the custom sauces that are pre-made in-house. My mom made the shrimples with the chipotle lime aioli, and like most boomer mothers, sent me a cute slideshow of the process and texted me, quote, "I made this. It was tasty. Dad would eat it again. Good to try new things. Making it kept me on my toes with 3 things cooking pretty much at the same time. So cool to have all the ingredients included. Shrimp was very, very fresh." And now my mom wants to try Green Chef for herself, so I told her to use our promo code. And you guys can too. Just go to greenchef.com/outfit50 and use code outfit50 to get 50% off, plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's greenchef.com/outfit50 and use code outfit50 to get 50% off, plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well.
So moving on to fashion, the List Index came out, and this happens every single quarter. It's basically a power ranking of brands based on data gathered from List.com, which is basically like a luxury shopping aggregator. Although I'm not convinced that anyone actually uses this. Like, have you ever used List in your life?
No, and I feel like you only happened upon this website because we were traveling for a week and just like ran out of podcasts to listen to, articles to read. It was like, oh, what's going on in the list?
Well, it's because the List Index gets so much press. So I'm just curious about the website itself. So basically it's like, yeah, you search for Prada skirt and it shows you the Prada skirts from Prada and Bergdorf's and, you know, Matches, whatever. So the List Index tracks your data on List.com, but also outside of List.com. So guys, List is stealing your information to make this list, just so you know.
Yeah, when you're on Net-a-Porter and that thing comes up of like, accept all cookies, and you're just like, yeah, sure, I want to see what they have in stock. That's where our information is going to.
Yeah. But apparently, like, 200 million people use it a year, although I don't know one of these people. So anyway, the noteworthy thing is that Miu Miu is now the hottest brand, dethroning its big sister Prada.
Which is not surprising, because it also came out this week that Miu Miu sales are up 89% from last year. And last year they were up 56%. I don't know how those numbers work exactly.
It's crazy because, like, yes, they've definitely done a bit of a pivot with their look, especially the styling of their fashion shows since they brought on Loda Volkova, since they did the crop tops and the micro mini. They've been pushing a very different look. But actually, when you go into the stores, it's like not that different than how it's been.
Well, because they can't keep the $800 swim briefs in stock.
Yeah, but it's still a lot of like baby doll dresses and stuff. They kind of did this hard pivot away from this sort of like 60s sweet little girl, jewel encrusted Mary Jane kind of vibe.
A very Elle Fanning look, I would say.
Yeah, very Elle Fanning, very Lula magazine. Into a look that's, I guess, a bit edgier. It's about showing your abs, that much I know. And it's about having a very messy bag with a lot of little charms hanging off of it and having wet look hair.
Well, the shortest shorts you've ever seen in your life.
I'm into it. It is just amazing that this has happened for them. Not that it was ever like a sad, directionless brand. People always shop there, but it's an amazing glow up, truly. And I do think that a lot of it has to do with styling almost more so than even the clothes. Because like I said, I don't think the clothes are actually that different. Expanding into menswear was smart for them. Having Troye Sivan in the fashion show, they now have a completely new audience that's obsessed with Miu Miu.
Obviously, fashion is cyclical, but there seems to be every 3 years an explosive growth with a new brand. Like, that was Gucci many years ago. It was also reported that Kering's profits have taken a tumble 40 to 45% in the first half of this year. A big reason for that is the design change in Gucci.
But also, isn't that just like the economy and people like just like not having the money to spend on this shit?
I don't know. Miu Miu sales are up. The other thing that I love about the list index, do you think they tried to call it the list and they were like, that's too cute? The number one hot product of the quarter are these Miu Miu New Balance suede shoes. Like, I love the look of the mesh ballet flats, but there are some items you see where it's like, I feel like if I purchased them, they'd already be out of style. Like, some things are so popular that it's like, I can't
actually
go there.
Really like those. Like, not for me personally, but I think they're a really gorgeous shoe, personally. And I do think the Miu Miu things, there are many Miu Miu items that were on the top 10 most popular things. It was the swim trunks.
Yes.
It was the little polo with the logo. And then it was these New Balance shoes. Crystal encrusted area jeans were in the top 10, but only because Taylor Swift wore them to the Super Bowl. And it created such a demand for this particular style that they were searched like crazy.
And the brand Area itself. And they report that it saw a 37% rise in searches this past quarter.
That's pretty crazy. Alaya entering the top 20 for the first time. Balenciaga is steadily rebounding following their cancellation. They've just been going up and up on the list.
This is where I feel like we're movie YouTubers or something, because we're like, this is as if it's the box office to us. We're like, Balenciaga up 4 spots to number 8.
And Saint Laurent, somehow at number 5, despite creating an entire women's collection out of pantyhose.
And the sheerest tops. Well, they've got sunglasses and they have great shoes, as on tour I borrowed your white sandals.
Yeah. Shall we move on to Brandy Helville?
Sorry, guys. I'm sure you're like, when are you guys going to talk about challengers? We're a little behind on our pop culture, so.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I will watch it this week. But I did see Brandy Helville, the new Brandy Melville documentary on, is it on Max?
It is indeed on Max.
On Max, with truly the greatest title.
One might say that it was more title than explosive documentary. Like many of these employees, I did think that maybe there was a Brandy Melville, or I guess maybe I thought it was like a newer version of Juicy Couture, and maybe one was named Brandy and one was named Melville, but it's like, no, it started by some Italian guy.
You know, I hated Brandy Melville going into this, so in theory, I'm the perfect audience for this movie. And it was difficult to watch, like, just because it's like everything looks so ugly, and it's such like visually, it's such an assault on my senses, like in an opposite way from J-Lo's This Is Me Now, but like I feel similarly just ravaged by watching this.
Brandy Melville is something that is a little after our time, and kind of from
a little, come on.
But it was something that was going on in the background that I understood was very popular amongst, I feel like, junior high girls.
Basic teenage girls shop at Brandy Melville, which it's hard for me to relate to as someone that grew up in the heyday of Delia's, because I feel like teen girls do deserve better. And I think if I was a teen girl now, I would be like a Marc Jacobs Heaven type teen girl and not a Brandy Melville.
Of course. And that was a big barrier to entry, is like, it's just so not my aesthetic that it's hard to comprehend how omnipresent and dominant this was as a style force for 10 years, 4 years. They're not really great on years in this documentary.
The biggest sort of allegations that were brought forth in this documentary were that they had like fucked up hiring practices where they just kind of hired random, like, hot, popular teenage girls that weren't necessarily good at working retail jobs. And then they would fire them based on their outfits and their bodies and stuff. And they had, like, very, like, racist hiring practices. Like, they kind of just wanted these, like, blonde, basic, tan, thin girls. And, of course, you have to be thin to wear Brandy Melville to begin with.
Because one size fits most.
I didn't know that Brandy Melville existed until recently. I went into the store in the Grove with Tat and her mother. And when Tat was like, there's just one size, I was like, oh, you have to be kidding me. Like, am I in a Seinfeld episode or something?
I felt like a few things that the documentary was lacking beyond the one Toronto store owner who speaks under shadows like it's a whistleblower in a 60 Minutes interview. There's not a lot of people that work at the company beyond the retail employees to kind of give you a context. And I was a little surprised when they get into the whole one size fits most that it wasn't mentioned, because I was like, I assume because they are really trying to push the margins as much as they can that it's like, I mean, we know it costs more money to produce other size ways. If you can just order one thing, that was not mentioned at all, which I found fascinating.
I mean, yes, they're losing out on certain clients that cannot fit into Brandy Melville and never will. But from a business standpoint, this is actually like the smartest thing ever.
I mean, obviously, it helps reinforce this body ideal that they have. But I think it was mostly for manufacturing costs, because you understand that this guy, Stefan, that started Brandy Melville, has been working in the clothing business for many years. I would have loved a little more background to seemingly the Brandy Melville days when it was just a store in Italy that had very random slogan shirts.
Yeah, but one fascinating thing that was revealed about Brandy Melville, which I didn't know, is the strong libertarian influence behind this brand.
Okay, that was crazy.
I guess the founder would leave Ayn Rand books around the Brandy Melville stores, and Brandy Melville even has a sub-brand that is named for an iconic character from an Ayn Rand book. Whatever the most famous one is, I forget.
Yes, the character of John Gant in Atlas Shrugged. Just the juxtaposition of, like, every Republican congressman's alleged favorite book from the 2010s being the only sub-label within Brandy Melville that a bunch of 16-year-olds are working at.
One thing that I actually thought was quite smart about Brandy Melville's business practices was the fact that, like, they have all these teen girls working in the store, which are their target customers. They would literally buy the clothes off of their backs and reproduce them, or they would basically just give them credit cards, let them buy shit on other websites. You know, they'd try on the order, they'd, you know, make tweaks, I assume, with a tailor, reproduce this shit, and then they'd actually name it after the girl whose clothes they stole.
So this I found frustrating about the documentary, because there is truly horrific and exploitive behavior and incidents that happened in the company, but the thing that you're referring to, they make it seem like that was super fucked up. And it's like, I'm sorry, but actually every single fast fashion label and every single fashion brand does this. They go on buying trips. Most brands don't directly buy something that is currently out in stores and go, let's just recreate that cheaper.
Yeah, let's just recreate that shirt that Layla's wearing and then call it the Layla shirt. But I do think there is a point to be made. It's like, okay, how much do fashion designers, let's say in their 30s and 40s, really know about teen girls. Like, they should be approving these things.
The Brandy Melville higher up perspective is, as I said, this man that is only speaking under the cover of darkness. And he's just like, how else will we find what the teenage girl wants if we just don't take what the teenage girl is wearing? My Maurizio Gucci accent was going wild while I was watching this documentary.
I know. Oh, they had a really fucked up, like, Slack channel, basically, within the company where they were sharing, like, racist and anti-Semitic memes. But, like, to everyone that worked there, including, like, the Italian manufacturing companies and shit?
Yes. So, again, the person I keep referring to is the only one that's commenting on this. And they're like, who was on the show? And he goes, everybody. And I was like, wait, the retail workers? And he's like, everybody. You know, Stefan, the factory, and Prato. Also the guy that runs this company, unsurprisingly, a big Trump supporter and hates paying taxes. Seems like they will probably get him on tax evasion. I thought that's what we were building up to, but seemingly no. I was also shocked to learn, because I feel like all of the Brandy Melville outposts that I've seen, like the one at the Grove, aren't there anymore. So I thought Brandy
Melville... No, it's still there.
Is it?
Look, that's just part of the Grove dead zone next to the See's Candies and the OVO store. It's like, we just don't think about that part of the Grove because there's nothing for us. Although I think there is a Gucci store going in across the way where Barney's used to be.
They do, throughout the documentary, lay out a kind of a tiered system of privilege amongst the different people that worked at the company. And the highest tier, and the most ominous, although they don't really delve into this that much, is the private apartment in New York.
The Brandy Melville, like, crash pad. It's basically like model apartments, but just for random, like, Brandy Melville employees that are, like, there for the summer or something.
And seemingly the executives that want to fuck them.
No, that was dark. And someone did get raped by... Was it an executive? It wasn't an executive at Brandy Melville, but someone else that worked within the company.
The woman did not press charges. And then that's sort of where they leave that element.
Well, we should also mention that a big part of their argument about why Brandy Melville is evil is just kind of a broader read of fashion in general and the wastefulness of it. Like, there's a lot of footage of this beach in Ghana where just all of our old clothes just go to die, basically. But it's like, there's no proof that any of that shit is Brandy Melville.
And so they're showing this B-roll, but it's Nike, Dolce & Gabbana. There wasn't a shirt that was like, you know, hell yeah, or like, but first coffee or something.
Yeah, you can find one Brandy Melville shirt on that beach, fine. But don't show me these, like, foam Dolce & Gabbana slides.
So my favorite Italian correspondent from this documentary basically is cool with all of this behavior until Stefan takes his Brandy Melville franchise away. So he doesn't directly say this, but he's almost like, I was a cool with racism, but don't take my Brandy Melville.
Right, because all the stores are franchised,
I guess, or the Canada one. Again, I would have loved if they got more into the backstory of, like, how exactly Brandy Melville became Brandy Melville. It starts with the girls that work in the store. When Paul and I were watching the documentary, and the girl that gets brought in as a photographer is like, it was really messy, like, in the back of the store. It's like, ooh, sorry, that is actually most of retail.
Yeah, when I interned for an unnamed iconic French luxury brand, their offices were basically the same as that footage of Brandy Melville.
The end is not really that explosive or has, I don't know, a satisfying ending. Because it's essentially these Business Insider articles came out talking about the exploitive nature of the company. A bunch of Brandy Melville employees took TikToks of themselves leaving their jobs. And then they make this big deal about how, like, you know, Stefan didn't even post an apology. It's like, good. Would you rather he give an apology he clearly didn't mean?
Oh, we also forgot to mention the detail of, like, at one of the Brandy Melville stores, like, the boss was always watching, like, footage of people coming into the stores. And there was, like, a red light, like, basically a button that would light up at the checkout if there was a customer that, like, the creepy pervs that were watching wanted to be photographed, like, for the Instagram, When they first showed the button, I was like, oh, is this like a Matt Lauer rape button or something?
That's what I
like,
thought.
Does the girl just like fall into like through a trap door into like this Brandy Melville like dungeon? Very dark, but you can take or leave the Brandy Melville documentary.
Yeah, because the documentary ends on a note of like, they're bigger than ever in China. Anyway, documentary over.
Yeah, it's like now they're giving like Chinese teenagers eating disorders too.
They call it the BM challenge, and I was like, bowel movement? Like, that's how little Brandy Melville resonates in my head.
Okay, well, everyone would think of bowel movement before Brandy Melville, unless you're completely deranged. On to the Galliano documentary.
Guys, we finally watched
it. Hip, hip, hooray. And it was very entertaining. Essential viewing for anyone who loves fashion. Fascinating story. Incredible archival footage. Top tier talking heads providing commentary.
Including the man himself who submitted to this documentary.
And the camp level at times off the charts, I have to say. There's obviously nothing funny about addiction, but when they're discussing all the crazy shit that he did while fucked up and juxtaposing it with all the footage of him walking the runway at the end of his fashion shows, it then becomes quite campy.
It does. So I didn't even start taking notes until he gets into the infamous homeless collection. Because right. I feel like that's the beginning of the unintended campiness of the documentary. Because, and we've discussed this collection ad nauseum, it's where the Carrie newsprint dress comes from. He's discussing in 2024, 2023, the inspiration for that collection. And he's like, well, in part, it's inspired by Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp and people I would see while I was running along the Seine who maybe chose to live like that, which is an insane way to refer to unhoused people.
I know. It's actually like kind of cool that like, it seems as if he has no PR, like, stock responses to anything. Like, when they ask him about a question about a very, like, controversial or potentially painful topic, it's as if he's just thinking of it now for the first time, like, in the moment.
Which, in a way, makes a little bit of sense when he begins to unpack his workload.
Yes.
Which he was doing 32 collections a year. Between Dior and his own label, he's doing 32 collections a year.
Yes, because that's inclusive of things like the Dior Kids line that he has to do a couple times a year. Like the fine jewelry watches, like when you add all of those things up, it becomes like a staggering amount of work to have to do. And work that he's also doing at the highest level of anyone in the industry, basically.
And Chell, I love you. I'm going to pause the podcast for a second. You have an eyelash right underneath your eye. It's so long and beautiful. Do you want to?
No, it's
you got it.
I mean, I don't give a shit.
You want to make a wish?
On a fake eyelash? No, I don't think that's necessary.
You don't think that will undo the missing of the rabbits?
I know. I need to see my lash girl this week. It's getting sparse up here, but...
Anyway, getting back to the documentary, they do a good job in explaining that the system of which he existed in, how it turned him basically into a frog in slowly boiling water, right? It went from designing two collections a year, really being able to marinate in your inspiration, into basically fashion at the time that he was at Dior from the late 90s into the 2010s becomes a corporation. But unfortunately, he's designing all of it. And so I was surprised at how late in the documentary cocaine is mentioned.
I know. Well, they didn't really overtly say that he was on coke. He kind of copped to being on prescription drugs and alcohol more. But yes, his right-hand man, Steven, who basically did everything with him, was on coke. And when Steven passed away, that's what really, like, led him to completely spiral out. Because, like, when you think about it, it's like 32 collections a year. Obviously, he's not designing every little thing. He has a whole staff. But when you have to manage that many people, that is like a nightmare job. And that's basically what Steven was doing, was managing everyone that was trying to execute his vision and sort of being his representative. And when he lost that, he then just had to answer all of those questions himself and had like a full breakdown.
Yeah, I would say the two incidents that probably bookend this is... his father dies in the early 2000s and Bernard Arnault gives him use of the private jet to go to the funeral, just so that he can be back in time for the runway show. And when Galliano says it, it's like, oh, so you could get back to prepping the show. They then cut to archival footage of him backstage where he is gacked out of his mind being asked about his father's funeral, and he goes, yes, the funeral was yesterday. And it's like, what?
It seems like a lot. Also, he had a very fraught relationship with his father, who was physically, verbally abusive.
He is oddly self-aware in one moment in the documentary. He's responding, you imagine, to the producer, director behind the camera, because he goes, when did I start to lose touch with reality? I don't know when that happened. It kind of happened slowly.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see that even through his fashion shows, which, you know, for the better, were kind of increasingly crazy.
Yes, there was definitely a tipping point. For those who are not familiar, designers typically come out at the end of the show. It's kind of per designer what their thing is. Some people walk down the runway, some people
just come out and wave and duck back behind stage. He basically, like, modeled at his own fashion shows and, like, voguing, like Naomi Campbell level, like, modeling.
And coming out in outfits that relate to the collection, which stopped happening. And then at a certain point, I would say the craziest of which is when he came out as an astronaut.
Yeah.
And they show it in the archival footage. I mean, I remember watching these runway shows as they happened, but first it was two bodyguards coming down the runway. Then it became four. There's a great quote from Sally Singer talking about how annoyed she was when he would grandstand and walk down the runway like that.
Yeah, she was real for vocalizing that.
For those who are not so familiar with John Galliano, just imagine Alfred Molina's character in Boogie Nights if he designed haute couture. Like, that's the energy we're talking about towards his later tenure at Dior.
It was, like, the juxtaposition of that imagery with all of the things that he did when he was fucked up. Also, the part where they show, like, that incredible Richard Avedon portrait of him where he's naked and his hair is really wild. And then they tell this story where it's, like, he's been banned from, like, 20 hotels in London. And at one of these hotels, he was completely naked in the elevator, acting like a lion, and when a guest tried to, like, get on the elevator and go to their room, he would, like, growl at them. And he did this for hours, apparently, at the height of the Dior era.
Yes, this was the Ritz in Paris, and the CEO of Dior had to go to the Ritz and pay for the entire weekend stay of every guest at the Ritz so they wouldn't talk about this, because, yes, no one could use the elevator for hours because John thought he was a lion.
He's so out of control. He's doing shit like this. The Dior people are like, okay, you got to have a meeting with the big boss. Like, we have to talk about this. So Bernard Arnault is like, John, you're an alcoholic, you're a drug addict, you need to take some time off, we got to figure this out. Apparently, Galliano ripped open his shirt and said, would an alcoholic have a body like this? And that's just so iconic of him.
And guess what? Bernard Arnault had nothing to say back to that.
He'd go through these intense cycles of, like, working a lot, partying a lot, then getting back to the gym and back in shape in this kind of, like, vicious hamster wheel.
There's also a clip of him working out in jeans. If you need to know how obsessed he was with the gym, just understand at a certain point he was working out in jeans.
Anyway, I guess we should talk about the anti-Semitic incident in question, which shockingly was in the first minute of this film.
Yeah, I mean, it's the narrative structure. And I think everything up until that point is trying to explain perhaps how he got to that place. Because in a way, you can look at it as the train was running and there was no way to get off of it. And it seems like he needed to self-destruct to get a break.
Like, I've seen these videos dozens of times at this point, but it's no less shocking. He verbally assaulted people at the same cafe on multiple occasions. And what happened was that one couple who he did this to went to the police, filed a police report. And then after that, a more damning video that had been filmed, like, weeks before was released. It's confusing. And Galliano himself was like, wait, I didn't realize I did that more than once.
The way that the producer, and I think it's his partner who are trying to explain this to him behind camera, do not explain this very clearly. He's like, but it's the video I've seen, right? And they're like, Well, yeah, but then there's another video.
And yeah, there's more than one video of you, babes. Like,
and then there's a title card that says there were actually three incidents. And it's like, what?
Yeah, so I guess there just wasn't video from the third incident, I'm assuming. I meant to look into that, but I forgot.
Which, this happened in 2010, I believe, or 2011. He left Dior in 2011, but I guess I've always wondered, like, if this happened today, having instantaneous cell phone footage makes sense, but that wasn't as regular in 2011. Like, I've always wondered, was it shot on an iPhone? Did they happen to have a video camera?
Yeah, it was at a point where everyone wasn't constantly filming everything. Absolutely. Also, it is suspicious, the leak of the second video after the first one. Did they try to bury it and then just give up and want to torpedo him? I don't know.
If Bernard Arnault wanted to bury all of those videos and pay off the French press, he easily could have.
Yeah. I feel like he was just like, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
Like, how, because how many incidents like this, or incidents like the Naked Lions situation, did they cover up, basically?
Yeah. How many hundreds of thousands of dollars of five-star hotel stays did they have to cover up his bad behavior? And at a certain point, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
What was interesting about this is, obviously, I've also seen the video where he's lobbing anti-Semitic remarks, but I guess I had never seen the second incident, which is technically happened first, which is he spews anti-Semitic hate against a woman, and then there's also an Asian man, and he is profiled in the documentary, and he seems quite unsatisfied. John Galliano was brought to court. He was found guilty of hate speech, or however it's phrased in France, anti-Semitic remarks.
In their weird-ass French court system that we learned about in Anatomy of a Fall, yeah. That I'm still just can't believe that that's how things work. But anyway.
This man came to Galliano's defense during the trial.
And was like, I don't think he's actually racist and anti-Semitic. But he said that later, he was like, I actually do think that he is. I just felt bad for him, like, in that moment.
Right, and it's like, well, what changed your mind? He's like, because he didn't apologize to me. The last third of the Galliano documentary is just full of unreliable narrators, because Galliano can't remember what he said or what he did. But the last part of the documentary is Galliano trying to understand why he did what he did. And I don't get the sense that he's gotten an answer 10, 15 years on.
No, it seems like he actually hasn't thought about it like that much, which is kind of crazy, because he did undergo like an extreme sort of like apology narrative. Like, he went to rehab, of course, which necessary, not just a PR thing, obviously. He then was like tutored by a rabbi, essentially, and spent a lot of time with some like Holocaust survivor, which sucks for that Holocaust survivor, honestly,
to have to explain his pain to John Galliano. Well, you're missing a key step, because it's not like John Galliano searched for this. It's Jonathan Newhouse who basically engineered his rehab tour and found all of these people for John Galliano to talk to.
Yeah, it's weird to me that he wasn't just like, yeah, I was raised in a anti-Semitic environment and that was passed on to me and I'm trying to unlearn the bad things that I've learned.
No, instead he's like, well, we're all a little racist. He's like, I don't know why I feel the way I feel.
He's like, I literally don't know why I said that. It's like, okay, well, you obviously like were anti-Semitic, or you wouldn't say it. Like, no one randomly says shit like that. He didn't just say anti-Semitic shit. He basically was like, y'all are ugly. Like, to all the people he verbally accosted, that was like half of it. He was just like, you look like shit. Your hair looks like shit. Literally like the nightmare of what people assume a terrible fashion person is. It's like the most extreme version of that. In addition to doing the whole thing with the rabbi, he also like did this Charlie Rose appearance that I watched at the time but completely forgot about, where it's like he completely like is in drag, basically, or like normal man drag. He's like wearing like a suit. His hair is pulled back. He's very like fresh faced.
For those who have not seen this Charlie Rose interview, just imagine Charlotte when she's doing the male drag in that episode.
I forgot that Charlie Rose used to be that place where you could go.
Until, you know, he got canceled, which again brings us to our reality show idea we've had for years, which is Canceled Man Island. Just Survivor with a bunch of canceled men. And there's another funny thing where again, it's Jonathan Newhouse who is engineering this comeback for Galliano.
Who's running Condé Nast, yeah. We should mention.
Who seems taken aback that no one wants to work with John Galliano in the years after this incident, even though, did you see him on Charlie Rose? It's like, yeah, he's toxic.
Yeah, and I remember when he was photographed in Vogue because he did Kate Moss's wedding dress, like, yeah, pretty shortly after his cancellation. And I was surprised to see that at the time. I was like, oh, wow, like, Anna really did go out on a limb. Also, we forget that Patricia Field was dragged in the initial aftermath of John Galliano's cancellation because she sent an email to like everyone in the fashion industry that was basically just like defending him. Anyway, Anna has always been ride or die and is still ride or die. I mean, she just photographed that whole Margiela Couture collection in Vogue this month. That was one thing I did find to be odd about this documentary. It kind of acted like he wasn't able to have a comeback, like he hasn't been killing it at Margiela for like a decade now. We didn't really get any of that. We didn't even get like a juxtaposition of he's going from basically modeling at the end of his fashion shows to not coming out at all because Margiela never came out. So it's like there was kind of no like
symmetry, narrative symmetry.
Well, and no information about anything he's done there. Like, you basically, the only thing that was shown was the couture collection from the year, the previous one. But there was sort of no discussion of like how he's evolved as a designer or the differences between what he's doing there and what he was doing at Dior, that sort of stuff. I would have liked to see more from the last decade of his life. He had a comeback pretty much immediately.
Yeah, in the scheme of things, only a few years.
A few years later.
Yeah.
So check that out, guys. If you're wondering, where the fuck do I watch this? You can rent it on Amazon Prime.
Although it's also available on Mubi, which I might need to get another streaming film service.
I know.
They seem pretty fab.
They do seem fab. We should do that. But yes, you can watch it for free on Mubi, or you can rent it on Amazon. Or it's in like a handful of theaters. Speaking of dark things happening at famous hotels, I just got the most sinister TMZ alert.
Oh boy.
Britney Spears paramedics called to Chateau Marmont for possible mental breakdown.
No. And
it's saying last night there was some kind of disturbance. Someone called the police claiming a woman matching Britney's description was harassing and threatening hotel employees and guests.
Oh, I just pulled up TMZ. Are you looking at the photos of
No,
her?
I know. The photos are upsetting.
Britney Spears got into a huge fight with her boyfriend Wednesday night and she ended up out of control, crying, possibly cut, and almost driven away in an ambulance, TMZ has learned. Britney got to the Chateau Marmont late Wednesday night with boyfriend Paul Solis, and there was some sort of disturbance and someone called the police. But officers showed up shortly after 10:30 p.m., but they saw no signs of trouble and left.
No signs of trouble. Okay, so then it's not a big deal. Anyway, to something else kind of dark. Shelley Duvall's New York Times profile.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't totally dark. It could have been much darker than it was. I actually kind of respected tone of it. It was written by Saskia Solomon for the New York Times.
And it seems like the overarching point of the article is sort of setting the stage for a Shelley Duvall comeback. She has a film that she just shot that I imagine will be coming out soon. But yeah, I mean, she was due for a profile, especially a mental palate cleanser from the Dr. Phil interview, which I feel like is the last significant piece of media we saw with her, which was incredibly distressing and never fully aired.
It never aired in full, but there was a bunch of clips of it. I just saw the clips from it. That happened in 2016. That was like the darkest year ever. I haven't really thought about it since. But as I remember, she said that Robin Williams was still alive.
And talking to her, yes. This at least paints a little bit more of a normal, quotidian picture of Shelley Duvall, which is she left Los Angeles. She lives a quiet life with her partner.
Her partner, Dan Gilroy, who is in a band called The Breakfast Club, which I only know about because Madonna was once in that band, and he also dated Madonna. Imagining dating both Madonna and Shelley Duvall. Iconic. But yeah, she lives in Texas. There was always kind of speculation that she left Hollywood because of, you know, some kind of mental breakdown possibly brought upon by The Shining in some way. But really, her house was damaged in the Northridge earthquake. And then her brother, who lived in Texas where she grew up, became sick. So she moved back. And then she just never really re-entered the film industry. She hasn't been in a film since 2002.
No, and it seems like the industry in part also forgot about her in the way that they often forget about women of a certain age. And also her health has taken a turn. I mean, one of the reasons she went on Dr. Phil, and they discuss this in the article, is that for whatever reason, she was asking him for help. I think the most distressing thing is her partner, Dan Gilroy, didn't know that she did the interview until days later, until people in town told him that this interview had happened.
And with regards to her health stuff, we know she has diabetes. She has some sort of foot injury, which makes it very difficult for her to walk, which is why she mostly just drives around in this car all day and then is like in a wheelchair or like sitting at home in her house. On Dr. Phil, it's like she had these sort of paranoid, delusional thoughts that one might associate with schizophrenia, although, of course, we don't know what actually is wrong with her mentally.
No, that is not spoken about in this interview.
God, it's like she just is the best actress. She's in the best movies. She's someone that I've loved since childhood because of Fairy Tale Theater, which was a completely genius show, which she also conceived of and produced and brought like the most amazing people in to work on that show.
Yes, if you are a fan of Tim Burton, Tim Burton's career exists because of Shelley Duvall. This was the first live action thing that he directed, and he used it to get the Pee-wee's Big Adventure job. So,
and if you didn't watch it like as it was airing, you just cannot imagine the caliber of actors that were on this show. And that's how I actually was introduced to a lot of famous actors. Like, I can't help but think of the Beauty and the Beast episode where it was like Susan Sarandon was Beauty, Klaus Kinski was the Beast, Angelica Houston was the sister, and Roger Vadim directed the episode. It's funny because it was like very heavily inspired by the Jean Cocteau Beauty and the Beast. So I remember when I finally watched that movie, like in a high school film class, I was like, wait, this is literally Fairy Tale Theater. It's so amazing. And they also like always really slayed with the casting of like the witches and stuff. Joan Collins was the witch in the Hansel and Gretel one. Vanessa Redgrave was this queen in Snow White. Like, it was so, so major. As someone that grew up loving fairy tales and also loving Disney movies, it created a really, like, necessary counter-narrative because you actually got to see, like, how fucked up the fairy tales actually were because they kind of kept them as is. Like, I remember being mildly traumatized by the Little Mermaid one,
right,
in which Karen Black played the sea witch. Anywho.
Yes, this had a huge impact on you. My introduction to her, because I was a weird child and watched Robert Altman movies when I was younger, is through her work with Robert Altman. My favorite of which is a film called Thieves Like Us. If you like Bonnie or Clyde or True Romance, I would suggest Bonnie and
pick
Clyde.
Pick a lane.
Or True Romance. Thieves Like Us is another great film in that genre.
I've never seen that. Three Women is my favorite Shelley Duvall. I think it's her best performance. Visually, it's kind of the most major thing. Her look is so major. And we also get Sissy Spacek.
Obviously, Shelley Duvall had a huge impact on us. I mean, for me, as someone with a lot of features on a small face, you know, she and I both have sort of Gollum-sized eyes. As a beauty counterpart, I always have appreciated her existence.
Of course, because it's so fashion, like her look. For one thing, it's the height and the extreme thinness, which is pretty unusual. I actually didn't know that her nickname was Texas Twiggy because of like how thin she was, but also like those long, crazy, spidery eyelashes that Twiggy also had.
A big part of the article is kind of dispelling the narrative that she was tortured by Stanley Kubrick, even though you can watch a lot of B-roll from the more than a year-long shoot of The Shining and see that he really does demean her, took many lines away from her, but she still fucks with Stanley Kubrick.
I mean, he got the most insane performance out of her. And by insane, I mean, like, her character in that film, it's kind of like nothing else you've ever seen. Like, you can feel the anxiety in a way. And I think it's probably because filming that movie sucks so much, although when she talks about it in this article, she's like, oh, I don't really remember that. I just remember that we would play cards and stuff.
Yeah, she had a great time, evidently.
She loved it, so.
I just remember from Angelica Houston's memoir, her talking about how Jack just, like, wasn't a great boyfriend during that time while he's shooting The Shining. And, like, clearly she has no idea what's going on set, but it just felt like a very Carrie Bradshaw, big, why are you being emotionally unavailable?
kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Also, I love that they interviewed the chick that runs the Instagram account, Shelley Duvall Archive, which I've been following for some time now. And she makes the correct point that it's like Mia Goth and Anya Taylor-Joy are the modern incarnations of Shelley Duvall. Like, of course, nothing hits like the OG, but it's so true. Like, the look, the acting style, the vibe, very similar. And those are, of course, two actresses that we love.
Shelley Duvall and Mia Goth specifically have 1930s face somehow.
Not sure if I'm going to see this movie. I watched the trailer and was like, I don't think I can do this.
It seems like it's probably a straight-to-VOD film.
Yeah.
So, Chell, I think we've really run through everything, right? There's nothing else to talk about, is there?
Card Dash, Aholics Anonymous.
This is a case for the FBI.
You're just a witch, and I hate you.
So Kanye's making porn?
Okay, so for those who do not like this segment, who especially hate when we talk about Kanye, just pretend that we've ended the episode. You know what? Actually, we'll do a sign-off now. Guys, it's been great. We'll be back early because the Met Gala is happening on Monday. We're going to drop an episode early. See you then.
Bye, guys.
Okay. Okay, everyone that hates the Kardashians and Kanye has dropped
off. Left the building.
What the fuck was this Yeezy porn announcement? Because he deleted it, right?
He posted something on Instagram that was just like cryptic text, like Yeezy porn is coming. We don't really know anything more about this. Honestly, I don't think him making porn is the worst idea because, like, I mean, not making it himself, but like producing it. Because my whole gripe with porn is that, like, all of the interiors look like shit. All the clothes that people wear, like the glam looks like shit a lot of the time. So if someone could fix those things, I think that would improve the situation. Porn in like brutalist Lydia Tarr apartments, like not the worst idea.
He does have that gutted brutalist cement mansion in Malibu that he can't seem to sell. Yeah, I want beautiful looking porn as well, but I feel like this has been a conversation going on for 20 years and no one has made it happen. And what concerns me about Kanye and his perfectionist tendencies, also the workplace violations that were like lobbed against him with Yeezy, but more specifically that academy, like I'm worried he's gonna make people fuck for 18 hours straight.
Yeah, true. Well, I'm hoping he's not actually directing it himself. I'm hoping he's just finding like a director that would otherwise be doing like a music video or something.
We don't know because he deleted everything.
We don't know, but can we get to the Milo Yiannopoulos of it all, which is the aspect of this that I actually care about?
Off pod, we have been talking about this and we didn't know how to bring this up because it's a weird fascination of ourselves. But at some point, former conservative troll Milo Yiannopoulos became the chief of staff of Yeezy.
Because he loves to embrace the canceled.
And so he wrote a letter on May 1st that said, I cannot be complicit in the production or dissemination of pornographic films and literature for moral and religious reasons, but also because such material and the kind of people invariably involved in its production represent an imminent danger to my life as a recovering addict and an unacceptable risk to my spiritual and physical health as a former homosexual.
Iconic.
I guess Yeezy porn is happening.
Okay, but I don't think Kanye's making gay porn. Or is it one of those things where even just like you'll just get turned on by the guy, even if you're watching straight porn?
Milo Yiannopoulos is like transgressive through utter repression. Conservative views have always fascinated me.
Of course, like when he called Trump daddy. Or when he would like go to college campuses to do his like deranged speaking engagements and he'd get like dads in MAGA hats to like carry him out like on a, what is it called? What's the Cleopatra thing called?
I don't know.
You know when they carry Cleopatra out? Like he would literally do that and it was like literally the gayest thing I've ever seen in my life. But like that didn't seem to register for anyone involved.
No. So a week before Milo Yiannopoulos got canceled, Chelsea and I, this is years ago, were intrigued of like, who is this guy? What is he? And we started watching these videos and we were like, oh, this is high camp.
Yeah.
There's another tweet. Now, to be fair, it is from Donda Times Twitter account.
What if I'm sure they're a really impartial source on all things Kanye.
Well, what if Yeezy porn is the upcoming clothing line made by Yee and Bianca? It would explain.
Yay.
Sorry. What if
ye old
Yeezy porn? It would explain why we saw Yay working on females underwear and Bianca going out with provocative outfits. I got news for you. I think Bianca would be dressing this way one way or another.
That makes sense. Like, they should just be making clothes.
I mean, they've been laying the groundwork with her paparazzi photos. Although, as I've maintained, the way that Bianca Censori dresses is the most egalitarian way someone can dress.
Absolutely.
Just go to Capizio.
Babe, that's one Amazon Prime order, yeah. And you have like a full look.
I think you should go as Bianca for Halloween.
Yeah, hard pass on that.
Anyway, we don't have much to say or much information, but we just had to get that off of our chest.
Yeah, I can't keep that in, especially his statement as a former homosexual. Well, also, wait, like, as a former addict, what was he addicted to? Was he, like, an alcoholic?
I don't know. I searched Milo Yiannopoulos addict, and all I can find, the fifth search result is from the Data Lounge that says chronic meth addict and Data Lounge troll Milo Yiannopoulos. Is this our most toxic episode we've ever done?
Let's end it now. Thank you guys for listening. We will be back next week.
Early, because the Met's happening.
Yeah.
Let's see if our prediction that Kim is going to wear Margiela comes true.
With her bush out, hopefully.
Oh, Kim with a merkin?
Yeah. All right, guys. Bye.
See you soon. Bye.